I wish everybody a wonderful afternoon. Today's Neurocast will be in English because today is one of those Neurocasts we do together with the Gesellschaft der Ärzte in Wien, the Society of Doctors, a very, very old and ancient institution, more than 150 years old. And we took the opportunity to work together once a month under the title of having people talking to us who had experience with new therapy, who knew people who invented specific therapies which are very useful for Parkinson's disease, like the levodopa therapy, still after 60 years, the gold standard of therapy. And I'm very pleased to have Thomas Brücke here as our today's guest and lecturer. He is a Parkinson's specialist for his entire life. He grew up already with levodopa therapy. He grew up with many of those people who had really big influence on this kind of therapy. And his father, and he will talk about that, had also to do with this topic and was one of the starters into the direction of levodopa therapy. So I'm very much looking forward in what you are going to tell us, Thomas, and I hand over to you.
Dieter, thank you very much for the kind introduction. And thank you and Bonsoir, Alish, for the invitation to give this talk. Yes, I was asked to talk about the history of dopa therapy in Parkinson's disease and also give a personal account. As Dieter already mentioned, the personal account, because my father somehow was involved in this dopa story. So then we can start. Can you give me the first slide? Let me see. I'm not quite sure if. Okay. It has been said several times that important discoveries in science can only be made by people who are standing on the shoulders of their predecessors. And actually, all the people who are very involved in this story I will talk about had been standing on the shoulders of those two people you see here. This is Otto Loewi on the right side, and on the left side, Sir Henry Dale. Both were pharmacologists who worked in the first half of the 20th century. And Otto Loewi was the head of the pharmacology department in Graz. Dale worked in London. And in the early 1920s, actually, they discovered the principles of neurohumoral transmission or neurochemical transmission. It was Otto Loewi who saw that when he stimulated the vagus nerve, that a substance was then set free which acted on the heart. So that was not a direct electrical stimulation of the heart via the vagus nerve, but a substance which was set free, which he called the Vagusstoff. And it was then discovered by Henry Dale that this Vagusstoff actually was acetylcholine, which he had already described years before. And this very important observation actually changed the whole thinking in neuroscience. And both Otto Loewi and Henry Dale received the Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine in 1936 because of this discovery of the chemical neurotransmission. And this picture actually shows Otto Loewi in his institute in Graz. And here, comes my personal history. Here is my father as a young assistant who worked in Otto Loewi's institute from 32 to 34. And he was very much influenced by Otto Loewi. He also became a pharmacologist and also was interested in the actions of the autonomic nervous system and also in neuropharmacology. And although these principles of neurohumoral transmission had been worked out in the 1920s, it was by no means so that this was generally accepted. It took several decades until about 1950, until this principle that nerves transmitted their impulses via a chemical transmitter was accepted. And one who disputed this very much was Sir John Eccles, who later also received a Nobel Prize, but he disputed very much with Otto Loewi and Henry Dale because he was convinced that the nerve impulses were transmitted electrically. And only after 1950, he agreed with this concept of humoral, neurohumoral transmission. He saw the phrase Dale's principle, which suggested that one neuron only would contain one neurotransmitter, which actually later turned out that this was not really true. But this Dale's principle means that different neurons were then called by their transmitter. So, for example, cholinergic or noradrenergic neurons. And only after 1960, actually, this concept was generally accepted. Now, to understand this dopamine story a little bit better, I just have to talk a few words about this substance, reserpine. Reserpine is a constituent of a plant called Rauwolfia serpentina, which grows in northern India, and which was used already in ancient Ayurvedic medicine. In the 1930s, it was rediscovered in India by Indian doctors who described the blood-lowering effects of plant extracts. And also, and this was probably even more important, the anti-anxiety effect in psychiatric patients. So interest was aroused in Europe, and Tsiba Geigy actually then isolated the substance reserpine alkaloid from this plant in 1952 and marketed it as Serpasil as the first antihypertensive treatment. And a few years later, it was also accepted that it could be used in patients with schizophrenia or psychotic patients because it had a sedative effect, which actually it was clear that it was not just an effect like a hypnotic, but that this was a specific antipsychotic effect, which was then called a neuroleptic. This term was actually created in 1955 by Däniker in Switzerland. And for a long time, it was thought that the effects of reserpine actually were due to a serotonin-releasing action either in the periphery or also in the brain. And this is, so as to say, the basis for the things that are talked about now. The first is dopamine as transmitter in the brain, the first part of the story. Until about the end of the 1950s, it had the dopamine synthesis and metabolism had been worked out, like you can see here. It was clear that the precursor of dopamine was L-DOPA, and it was known since I think the 40s that L-DOPA was transformed by L-dopa decarboxylase into dopamine. Dopamine was thought to be only the precursor substance for the synthesis of noradrenaline, which was thought to be the substance which was more important. And nobody actually believed that dopamine has had a role as its own. And it was also known that L-dopa could cross the blood-brain barrier, whereas dopamine and noradrenaline could not. And it was also known that dopamine and noradrenaline were broken down by monoamine oxidase, and that monoamine oxidase inhibitors also had an influence on the action of these amines. Important findings were published in 1957. In August 1957, a British group, Kathleen Montagu, described dopamine in the brains of different species, including humans. And only a few months later, the same group actually showed that dopamine was localized intracellularly, which already suggested that it has a special, maybe transmitter role. Now I have to introduce the first major actor in this story. It's Arvid Carlsson. Arvid Carlsson was born in Uppsala in 1923. He studied medicine in southern Sweden, in Lund, until 1951, and then started at the pharmacology department in Lund. 1955, he went to the National Institute of Health and worked with Bernard Brody. Bernard Brody was a very known figure at the time, and he was working on many different aspects of pharmacology and neuroscience. And Brody was convinced that reserpine acts via releasing serotonin in the brain, and that all the effects of reserpine were actually the effects of serotonin release in the brain. And Arvid Carlsson stayed, I think, only half a year there in the laboratory, and also worked with reserpine and serotonin, and described that reserpine actually released serotonin from thrombocytes. He then went back to Lund, to the pharmacology, and shortly thereafter became head of the pharmacology in Göteborg. And his major discoveries actually are described here. I will go into detail then. He described first in 57 the antagonism of the reserpine effect by L-dopa. And then he described dopamine as a transmitter in the brain, and that dopamine was concentrated highly in the striatum, which possibly had a connection to Parkinson's disease. And I will show all this in detail. For these three publications, he received the Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine in 2000. And he died a few years ago, 2018, with at the age of 95, actually. So this is the first of the very important papers of Carlsson and his co-workers, which appeared in Nature in 1957. And if you see that, it's not even one page in Nature, it's a letter to Nature. And in this letter, the group described that the effect of reserpine, especially in rabbits, they also did experiments in mice, and they described that reserpine had an effect which led to a severe akinesia in these rabbits. They just were laying down, their ears dropped, and when they then were injected with dopa intravenously, after several minutes, these rabbits jumped up and moved around quite normal, which was a quite remarkable effect. And it could also be shown in this experiment that the precursor substance of serotonin, because the question still was, does reserpine act on serotonin or on catecholamines? And the precursor substance of serotonin, 5-hydroxytryptophan, actually did not have an effect. L-DOPA or DOPA was known as a precursor for noradrenaline and dopamine. And the next paper appeared just a few months later in February 1958 in Science this time. Again, only half a page. And this paper describes again the experiment in the rabbits with the severe echinacea after injection of reserpine. And then it was the dopamine and noradrenaline content in the brain of these rabbits was measured. And it was shown that reserpine actually depleted the dopamine content almost completely, to a lesser degree also noradrenaline. And after the injection of IV, in this case it was DL-DOPA, the dopamine content was restored and the noradrenaline noradrenaline concentration actually didn't change very much. So by this, for Carlson, it was clear that it actually was dopamine which played the major role. Serotonin was, in his view, out of the window. And the third publication of the group appeared again 1 year later in 59. And this paper actually aroused many researchers who were working in the field on this catecholamine is in the brain and the effect. And this paper actually showed first that dopamine was present in the brains of different species that had already been shown by Montagu, actually. But the important thing was that the distribution within the brain showed a high concentration of dopamine and not of noradrenaline, actually, in the caudate nucleus. And it was known at that time already that the caudate nucleus and the putamen had a very important role in the motor control. It was the extrapyramidal motor system was known to play a major role. So already Carlson and his co-workers speculated that this high content of dopamine, which can be depleted. They didn't do it in the dogs, but in the rabbits, probably points to the fact that this dopamine plays a role in motor control and maybe also in diseases of motor control like Parkinson's. Now the next part of the story starts. It is the dopamine deficiency in Parkinson's disease. And so I have to introduce the next major player here. This is Ole Hornikiewicz. Ole Hornikiewicz was born in Lemberg in Galicia, 1926. Lemberg was, and the Western Ukraine was part of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, actually, until 1918. Then it became Poland. When Hornikiewicz was born there, it was Polish. And his family fled from there in 1939 because then the Russians took over the Western Ukraine. It's quite a parallel to what is happening now. So his family emigrated to Vienna, and here Ole Hornikiewicz went to school and then afterwards did his medical training. And after 51, he then started his work as a pharmacologist in the Pharmacological Institute in Vienna. From 56 and to 57, he went to Oxford to work with a man named Hugh Blaschko, who was an emigrant from Berlin and who was an important figure in this catecholamine research. He had figured out the metabolism and the synthesis of adrenaline, in fact, and also suggested that dopamine has a role on its own. And on the other things I will talk about then, 1960, 1960 and 1961 were very important years where all these major things took place. I also want to mention that Honickiewicz stayed in Vienna until 67 and then moved to Toronto, where he became head of the Clark Institute of Psychiatry in Toronto, a research institute where he continued his research on dopamine and the brain. And after 1977, he returned back to Vienna, where he became head of the biochemical pharmacology department and died here in Vienna 2 years ago, just at the beginning of the corona pandemic. Here's again my personal story somehow. This is a picture of the collaborators of the Pharmacological Institute with my father here in the middle. He is Olli Honickiewicz. This was taken in 1960. Kraup was the followed my father on the chair in pharmacology. And all these people sitting in front later became heads of pharmacological institutes and departments all over in Germany and Austria. For example, Herting was then became head of the pharmacology in Freiburg in Germany, and also had worked in at the NIH with Julius Axelrod, who also won the Nobel Prize for medicine. Here again is my father and Honickiewicz in 1960, together with Otto Kraup, who later became head. And this picture shows actually Honickiewicz when he spent his 2 years in Oxford with Blaschko. And Blaschko actually told Honickiewicz he should work with dopamine, or he gave him the task to study the effect of dopamine and noradrenaline on the blood pressure in the guinea pig. And Honickiewicz found out that dopamine actually had the opposite effect as noradrenaline in this model, which suggested to him and Blaschko that dopamine has a biological function of its own, also in the peripheral nervous system. And when Honickiewicz returned to Vienna, Blaschko advised him, "Olli, you should stick to dopamine, has a bright future." I don't know if he said it in English or in German, because actually his native tongue was German. And after returning back to Vienna, Honickiewicz had possibilities, or the possibilities at the institute in Vienna were not the same as they were in Sweden and England, where modern and sensitive laboratory equipment existed. For example, spectrofluorometers for the measurement of catecholamines such as dopamine. So Honickiewicz had to improvise at the institute, and he used old footballs to exert pressure to exchange columns to separate these catecholamines. So this was the machine which was quite unconventional and improvised. Now I introduced third important player. This is Walter Birkmeier. Walter Birkmeier was born in Vienna in 1910, so he was almost a generation older than Carlsen and Honickiewicz. And he did his medical training in Vienna and also his specialization in neurology and psychiatry at the university here. From 1940 to 1945, he was head of a brain trauma unit in a military hospital, where he saw a lot of brain shot wounds with different neurological outcomes. And in 1954, he became head of a big neurology unit in the geriatric hospital in Linz in Vienna. At this time, in the middle of the 1950s, many patients were treated there who suffered from post-encephalitic Parkinson, because in the early 1920s, this encephalitis lethargica affected many people here and also in other parts in Europe and elsewhere. And in well, 30 years later, many of these patients actually were treated in neurological departments as in Lainz. And so Honickiewicz had a lot of experience in treatment of Parkinson's disease and post-encephalitic Parkinsonism. And the main treatment consisted of anticholinergic treatment. Again, this red things like 61 and what happened, I will talk about then. Walter Birkmeier died in 1996 in Vienna. Now, what happened between 58 and 1960 in Vienna? There was an important period. 1958, after his return from Oxford, Honickiewicz, together with his colleague Holzer, studied dopamine concentrations in the rat brain and also the effect of MAO inhibitors, which they could show increase the dopamine content. And so at this time already, he was involved in dopamine research. And at the same year about, Walter Birkmeier, who knew my father, or they knew each other quite well already, he approached my father at the Pharmacological Institute and suggested to measure serotonin in the hypothalamus of post-mortem brain samples of two patients who died of Parkinson's disease. And he brought these brain samples of frozen brains to the institute. And my father actually recommended Honickiewicz, who had just come back from England, to do this examination, or that Walter Birkmeier should talk to Honickiewicz. Honickiewicz then was a little bit reluctant to do this, and he later said that he didn't see any really rational background for a study of serotonin in the hypothalamus of Parkinson's disease, and stored the brains away in a freezer, which understandably annoyed Birkmeier quite much. 1 year later, when these Carlson papers came out, especially the paper of Bertrand Rosengren, where they described that dopamine was concentrated in the extrapyramidal motor system, Honickiewicz immediately had the idea to study dopamine and its concentrations in the human brain, and especially in Parkinson's disease, because he actually thought that Carlson's group probably would do the same immediately, because it was quite apparent, and many people who were working in the field actually had similar ideas, as I will show later on. So Honickiewicz, and together with Ehringer, this was his new collaborator after Holzer, actually started to measure dopamine in the human brain. And they gathered brains of normal controls and also of patients with Parkinson's disease from the pathology department at the clinic, but also in this case without Birkmeier's help, because Birkmeier already was sour. So they contacted the pathology department in Linz directly to get brains from patients with Parkinson's disease, and started to measure dopamine and noradrenaline. And at the end of 59, it actually, the first results in three Parkinsonian patients already showed the depletion of dopamine. Honickiewicz later said that he could see it, when he measured it, he could see it with his naked eyes, because this reaction gave a pink color in the normal controls, and in Parkinson's disease, this color was absent. So he was very enthusiastic to publish these results and went to my father, but my father said, no, this is not possible with only three brains, this could be just a chance finding, and the finding could be wrong. So he advised him, be patient, gather more Parkinsonian brains, and then this can be published. This Honickiewicz was not happy about this. And I don't know if he was happy about that, but in February 1960 at the conference in Belgium in Liège, my father gave a talk about catecholamines in the brain, I think, and mentioned Honickiewicz results, which seemed to show a dopamine depletion in the putamen and caudate nucleus in Parkinson's disease. And he pointed to a possible role of dopamine in the extrapyramidal motor system. And this, he said that this, of course, were Honickiewicz results. And this actually was published in French in this in a Congress report from Liège in 1960. So this was probably the first mention of a dopamine depletion in Parkinson's disease. And until the September 1960, Ehring and Honickiewicz had gathered 17 control brains, six brains of patients with Parkinson's disease and two Huntington's disease, and had studied these. And the results of this study appeared relatively soon after the paper was written in December in German in the Journal of Klinische Wochenschrift. Maybe my father had a bad conscience, but he actually, when this publication was sent in, he also sent a letter to the editor where he maybe asked for accelerated publication. And it actually, this paper came out only 2 months after it has been sent in December 1960. But before the paper was sent in, there was a meeting in the Pharmacological Institute. And the reason was Birkmeier actually wanted to be co-author of this publication. Although I don't even know if these brains which Birkmeier had brought to the Pharmacological Institute actually were part of this examination. And it was not serotonin which had been measured, which he had thought about, but it was dopamine. And so at this meeting, my father was present and Honickiewicz, and together Birkmeier was persuaded to refrain to be an author on this paper. And actually my father also didn't appear on the paper because it was meant to be Honickiewicz's rehabilitation treatise. Birkmeier agreed to this, but he requested that it should be mentioned in the publication that he has had the idea to measure serotonin in the brain of Parkinson's disease in the hypothalamus. And this is the publication in Klinische Wochenschrift in German, which later became a citation classic. And the publication described, on the one hand, the distribution of noradrenaline and dopamine with a high concentration in the striatum. This had already been shown also by others, like Sano in Japan. I will come to that in the end. And in the paper is also mentioned that Birkmeier actually advised to measure serotonin in the hypothalamus of patients, but that this was actually not possible because they wanted to measure dopamine, because dopamine has a role in the extrapyramidal system. And that Honickiewicz described that they were not, they couldn't measure serotonin because there was not enough material. And the results in Parkinson's disease were dramatic. The content of dopamine in the caudate was high in normals, very low, almost not measurable in post-encephalitic Parkinson, and also very low in Parkinson's disease. The same in the putamen. And also noradrenaline was reduced somewhat to about 50% in the hypothalamus. This again shows the results. Normals, light blue in caudate and putamen, and in Parkinson's disease, a massive reduction. Well, these results were celebrated in the Pharmacology Institute in the basement. You see Honickiewicz here and a lot of his other assistants of the institute. And here's a picture of about 1960 of Ole Hornikiewicz and Walter Birkmeier together. So this is now the last part of the story, is L-DOPA as a treatment for Parkinson's disease. Immediately after the publication of the postmortem results, Hornikiewicz actually approached Birkmeier several times and tried to persuade him to test L-DOPA in patients with Parkinson's disease. Birkmeier was still angry at Hornikiewicz because he, from the beginning, hadn't measured serotonin, and then he wasn't a co-author on the paper which was written on dopamine. So he didn't really react. And so Hornikiewicz came up to my father and asked him for a common meeting with Birkmeier, which took place in the beginning of 68 in the Pharmacological Institute. And Birkmeier was actually given a supply of 2 grams of L-DOPA and a thorough instruction how to prepare the L-DOPA for IV injection. And again, after several months, after delay until June, Birkmeier then finally injected the first patient with L-DOPA. And shortly thereafter, he called Hornikiewicz to come and see for himself. And I let you see, maybe many of you have already seen this movie, which was made by Birkmeier in Linz. And this movie is actually was then later rejuvenated by Peter Riederer, and he has a copyright on this movie, so please don't copy this, but actually many of you might have seen it. So this shows that a patient with severe Parkinson's disease. This patient was quite well known. She's called Liesl Sporer, had a post-encephalitic Parkinson for 26 years, and you see that she's quite akinetic, has a stooped posture, this shuffling short base gait, no arm swing, especially this cramped cornea posture is seen. She can't really jump. These were special tests which were made by Birkmeier. And this is 20 minutes after the IV injection of 50 milligrams of L-DOPA, which is not a high amount. And this had an astonishing effect. As you can see, the akinesia was markedly reduced. She could stand up easily. She could move her hands much better. Then her gait is much improved, although it's still not normal, and also the posture is not normal yet, but much better. She can turn around, she can jump on one leg, she can do these, I don't know how to call it, kniebeugen. And you see that also the mimic is improved, and at the end, she even jumps into her bed. So this was a remarkable effect, and Hornikiewicz actually had seen that and wrote a letter to my father about this, and my father answered, it is very interesting, these therapeutic success of L-DOPA is very interesting, and I value this very much because you have seen it yourself. And then he also writes that he went by car the day before on the Großglockner. He was never a very good car driver, and he said this was a very tight thing. I don't know what it meant. Maybe he just almost went off the road. So then, not long after this first movie was made, actually, Birkmeier had already injected about 20 patients with Parkinson's disease. And this effect was quite dramatic also in the other patients. And the paper on this, paper by Birkmeier and Hornikiewicz, then appeared in the Wiener Klinische Wochenschrift, again, a German scientific paper. And here in the paper, it says the effect of a single IV administration of L-DOPA was, in short, a complete abolition of and substantial release of echinacea. Bedridden patients who were unable to sit up, patients who could not stand up from sitting position, and patients who, when standing, couldn't walk, they performed all these activities after L-DOPA with ease. So it's a very enthusiastic description of the first use. And actually, Birkmeier from that time on was a really believer in the L-DOPA therapy, which not everybody was. And at the meeting at the Wiener Ärztegesellschaft, in the where this actually this virtual talk now should have taken place, there was the lay press was there, and Birkmeier and Hornikiewicz presented their data. And in the lay press, it was written about the dopamine miracle that crippled could move again for hours. Viennese doctors find a method which can lead to success in previously incurable disease in the Arbeiterzeitung. Now, from this time on, actually, Walter Birkmeier and Ole Hornikiewicz had a very good correlation, a good cooperation, and published several papers together. And without Birkmeier's enthusiastic support of this DOPA therapy, probably they wouldn't have had this response, which actually was there. Although many people didn't really believe in the story yet. And I will show you what happened then outside Vienna. But at about 1970, when Hornikiewicz then had moved to Canada, to Toronto, to work, there was a quarrel between Hornikiewicz and Birkmeier, because Birkmeier had given an interview to a newspaper where he apparently had talked about that Hornikiewicz had worked as his assistant, and also turned things around a little bit so that people could believe that he was the one who had actually invented the dopamine story and this DOPA. And Hornikiewicz was angry and wrote back to this newspaper and to respond to this interview of Birkmeier. And then Birkmeier wrote a letter to Hornikiewicz where he actually wrote, "Because da du mich damals so abfahren ließest, because you put me off so much," that means that he didn't measure serotonin, that Hornikiewicz was not on the first postmortem paper, "I have retaliated with a 6-monthly blockade of your DOPA therapy. And with this, my aggression is totally neutralized and a true friendship is made place." And unfortunately, this the friendship actually ended in 1970, because the Hornikiewicz and Birkmeier's actually relationship then was not a very good one anymore. And now, in the end, just words, what happened outside Vienna in 1960 to 1962, after this first report, or even before, I will mention Sano in the end. And important also is the story about Dekwitz. Dekwitz, he was a psychiatrist who worked in Frankfurt and had also read Carlson's papers with the depletion of dopamine in the rabbits, and then the restoration of the dopamine content after the application of DOPA to the rabbits. And he had actually seen that patients who received rezepine because of psychosis developed extrapyramidal side effects, Parkinsonian-like symptoms, and gave these patients IV L-DOPA. That was already in 1960, before the DOPA therapy in Parkinsonian patients started. And he also described a method to dissolve L-DOPA and described that these rezepine-treated patients got better, at least for a while, when they had received L-DOPA. So this was a very important discovery. Outside Vienna, actually, almost at the same time as Hornikiewicz and Birkmeier, there was a group. This was Ted Suits, he was a pharmacologist, and André Barbeau, he was a neurologist at McGill in Montreal. They measured dopamine in urine of Parkinsonian patients and found a decrease, and then also started to give L-DOPA to Parkinsonian patients, Barbeau and Suits together. And they reported about a positive effect of oral L-DOPA in Parkinson's disease already. Only in 1964, actually, it became clear that there was a connection between the substantia nigra and the caudate nucleus and putamen, where the dopamine depletion was seen, because it was a riddle until that time that the pathological changes in Parkinson's disease, which had been known already for a long time, were only seen in the substantia nigra, but this dopamine reduction was seen in the striatum. And that was also led to a lot of disbelief in many people about this dopamine story. But then elegant papers of Dahlström and Fuchs in Sweden actually showed that there was a connection of the substantia nigra to the striatum, which was a dopaminergic connection, and they lined out these neurons from the substantia nigra to the striatum and from the ventral tegmental area to the mesolimbic area. And that was a very important finding, which actually explained the DOPA story. Now, until 1967, one has to agree that it was known that L-DOPA had a good effect. At least it was known in Vienna and in Canada and other places in the world. But in America, George Kotsias is seen as the discoverer of L-DOPA. Although you could say he did the right thing, despite he had a totally wrong hypothesis. His hypothesis actually was that the loss of melanin in patients with Parkinson's disease causes Parkinsonian disease and all the symptoms. And he wanted to restore melanin in the brain by giving high oral doses of L-DOPA. The high doses of L-DOPA were not available in Europe because it was very expensive. So Kotsias managed to get this in America. And he started then to treat Parkinson's patients with relatively high oral doses, up to 8 grams, and described also a lot of side effects. But it turned out that it actually had a good effect in patients, a good anti-akinetic effect in patients with Parkinson's disease. And of course, also this opened the way for the clinical use of DOPA, because it was not possible before to send patients home and with an IV treatment with L-DOPA. This could only be done in the clinic. And Kotsias then published these results in the New England Journal of Medicine with these high DOPA doses and the effect. And from that time on, actually, this DOPA treatment became generally accepted and then also available. But actually, in the same year, Birkmeier and Mentasti described for the first time that a combination of L-DOPA and the decarboxylase inhibitor benzerazide actually in the treatment of Parkinson's disease actually improve the effect of L-DOPA. And this is still the gold standard of Parkinson therapy. And this paper by Birkman and Mentaste actually is somehow totally overlooked. This is still the same principle also with this combination or with the combination which is used in CINEMET. And another story in Vienna was Peter Riederer, who in 1975, together with Musa Yudim and Birkmeier, actually introduced MUB inhibition in the therapy of Parkinson's disease with the inhibitor selegiline, which was called Umex, and what was later followed by rasagiline, which is still also a main therapy in Parkinson's disease. Now, just at the end, a short mention of missed chances. One who missed a chance was Wilhelm Raab. He was a cardiologist who was born in Vienna. He emigrated to the United States in 1938. And then he had a lot of scientific enthusiasm and ideas. And one of his interests was also catecholamines in the brain. And he measured in large experiments in different species. He actually measured sympatine, which was noradrenaline. And then he discovered a substance which he called enkephaline, which he described as very similar in its effects as sympatine or adrenaline, but it differed in some aspects in the chromatography results and so on. And he called it enkephaline and showed that enkephaline was very highly concentrated in the caudate nucleus of different species, even in man also. Then he was interested that also in psychiatric disorders, that he studied enkephaline in the brain of humans in people with psychosis. But he, unfortunately, he didn't follow up this idea and he never really clarified exactly what enkephaline was. But actually, these papers were known to the first people who worked with dopamine, like Montagu, who described dopamine in the brain, and she also mentioned the work of Wilhelm Raab. Some people called him a genius, but he was a little bit disorganized and didn't really stick to these things, so that he actually might have been close to the big discoveries, but missed them. And another one of missed chances was that of Isamu Sano. He was a Japanese neurologist from Osaka in Japan, who had worked in 2 years in Freiburg and Munich. And actually in 59, when he was back in Japan, he did measurements of dopamine and noradrenaline in the human brain and also described the high concentration of dopamine in the striatum. This was roughly at the same time as Bertel and Rosengren did their experiments in dogs. And this was published in 1959. And also Hornikiewicz was aware of this paper. So he had described distribution of dopamine, but not and in this paper, not a loss in Parkinson's disease. But apparently a year later, 1960, he also measured dopamine in one brain of a diseased patient with Parkinson's disease, and also tried DL-DOPA intravenously in two patients with Parkinson's disease, which were actually only examined laying in bed. And they only examined the rigidity by means of electromyographic experiments, and didn't actually see the effect of DL-DOPA, missed this, maybe just because the patients were not examined walking around. And both this loss of dopamine in one patient, which was about 50% of the normal control value, was published in 1960 in a Japanese Congress report in Japanese. And so nobody was aware of these findings. But Hornikiewicz knew about Samu's work of the distribution of dopamine in the brain, not of the thing, not of the result that he also had measured it in one brain of Parkinson's disease, and sent him reprints of his and Birkmeier's work. And Sanu actually answered him, "Sehr verehrter Herr Dr. Hornikiewicz, dear Dr. Hornikiewicz, thank you very much for friendly sending me the reprints of your very interesting paper. The problems in which I was interested and with those I myself work, actually you, Herr Doctor, have solved. And I congratulate you from all my heart." And the last picture here is one of Carlson and Birkmeier in the later years. Carlson, as I told you, received the Nobel Prize for Medicine and Physiology in the year 2000. And it is stated that he got it for his detection of dopamine as a transmitter in the brain and for his basic work, which then was followed by the clinical work, which led to the discovery of dopamine loss in Parkinson's disease and L-DOPA treatment in Parkinson's disease. He got the Nobel Prize, but Hornikiewicz and also Birkmeier were left out. And a lot of scientists all over the world actually were not happy that Hornikiewicz was not included and didn't receive the Nobel Prize together with Carlson, as many thought would have been right. And they wrote a letter to the Nobel Committee, actually. And and told them the, that they actually thought that Hornikiewicz should have been included in the Nobel Prize, but this actually was too late. And Birkmeier already had died years before the Nobel Prize actually was rewarded. And with this, I want to end and thank you for your attention. And I will be happy to answer questions if there are any. Thank you very much.
Thomas, great applause. You can't hear it. Great applause from everybody. This is really an interesting story. I've heard it many times from many proponents from different sides, from Birkmeier, from Hornikiewicz, from Jellinger, from others. So this is really a very, very interesting story. It's like a creamy. And I can hear
the
it over
chats,
and over.
We would say that, today, the DOPA chats.
Yes, it's like Watergate. So it's really an interesting topic. And on the other side, it shows that one should be aware of how things happen, how big inventions are made. There's a lot of personal things. There's a lot of ideas, a lot of missed ideas, as you pointed out. So this was really an interesting part. Why is something happening and other things not? And why is it all at the same time? So this is really a wonderful and interesting story. I didn't expect that we will have too many questions on this topic. I wanted to point to one thing Francois just put into the chat. This is what you find on the far right-hand side in red. This is the link to the thing we had, the meeting we had on the 11th of November last year.
Yeah.
Which was exactly the day, 60 years, day and time, 60 years after the first presentation of the levodopa therapy in the Gesellschaft der Ärzte in Vienna. It was a nice thing we had. Only a few people attended because it was still COVID time. And it was one of the outcomes of this evening that François and myself decided to use our connection to the director of the Gesellschaft der Ärzte to form a joint venture and to make those historical, very important lectures together with the Gesellschaft der Ärzte, and not that we do it alone for us. Has somebody something to say to that?
I'm afraid it is very complicated to ask a question there, because this is history, and you made a fantastic presentation about this. This would be a wonderful script also for a movie. Not the third man, but maybe the Dope or something like this. I think this is really fascinating. But I have a question. We all know that levodopa is a fantastic therapy for Parkinson's patients, and you never mentioned the commercial backgrounds of all that, because I think at the beginning this was experimental, but later this became very commercial. And today I realize there's a lot of commercial issues there inside. And you did not mention all the therapy that was going out, so agonists or so, which has nothing to do with the true story here. But the question is, where are we? Can you say some words about this ongoing discussion that is going back and forth and right and left? Where are we today with all these therapies?
Well, maybe I can also start with a historical remark. Actually, it was a commercial issue that it was very difficult to obtain large quantities of, especially L-DOPA in the early 60s. And that was also the reason why most of the people working with this actually used it intravenously, which then prohibited actually that this was broader used in the clinic. And it was only possible then in America. Kotzias maybe had a better relation to big companies in America. And it costed a lot of money to produce, especially the active isomer L-DOPA, so that many people also worked with DL-DOPA, which was cheaper, and that also might have had an effect that they didn't see the right response as it was seen in Vienna. But it was a commercial issue. Hoffmann-La Roche was interested in this story, and Hoffmann-La Roche was also involved actually then in the discovery of Birkmann-Mentasti, or the description that the decarboxylase inhibitor enhanced the effect of DOPA. This was something which was also not known. Actually, Pletcher and Hoffmann-La Roche thought that if the decarboxylase inhibitor was given at the same time as DOPA, the effect should have been abolished. And they were really astonished when Birkmeier said, no, the effect is doubled now. So it's working much better. Then they thought, well, now he's really crazy. But it turned out that Birkmeier was right, that his clinical experience actually, that he saw the right thing, that the combination of the decarboxylase inhibitor and DOPA was the right thing. Yeah. About then the commercial issue was very big with the dopamine agonists, I think, that the big companies who produced these dopamine agonists pushed the dopamine agonists very much. And so it was almost said that L-DOPA is toxic, and many people were afraid to take DOPA because they could get dyskinesias or something, or it could aggravate Parkinson's disease, which turned out to be totally false. And dopamine agonists, well, they have their advantages, of course, but it also was seen that they have the disadvantages with the impulse control disorder and so on. So they now I think they the companies, they, how do you say, the patent has run out, and now the interest is getting less. Now the pendulum swings back to L-DOPA mm-hmm. again. So I think this has a lot to do with commercial interests.
But it is so important, as you, with your pharmacological background, you point that out, because people are really, or patients are often afraid that, as you said, that DOPA is toxic. It's very much like the topic with the vaccination. I think it's very important that this is pointed out. We know that vaccination, COVID vaccination, might make side effects or complications even. But in the majority of the cases, this is a beneficial therapy. And I think it's important that we say the same, I think, the same also for levodopa, and mm-hmm. not go in this direction that the commercial industry has as good selling arguments. I want to have your ideas there about.
I didn't.
That this is a good therapy. Still, it's not.
In my view, actually, L-DOPA is the best working, still the best working drug in Parkinson's disease. There's no question about it. There's also no question about it. It's side effects, of course, and it's difficult in advanced stages of the disease with this hyperkinesias, with these on-off effects, which haven't been really solved with the pharmacotherapy. Of course, the other line now is the operation and deep brain stimulation, which is very interesting.
Not today. We are.
But what I think also, well, a historical note again, what I think is very astonishing when you look back at all these discoveries, even from the beginning with Otto Loewi and Henry Dale, that it takes decades until people accept things. For example, that dopamine is a transmitter in the brain. I mean, Carlson was traveling from one meeting to the other and nobody believed it. They still thought about serotonin and didn't think that dopamine was a transmitter on its own. They also always said it's just an intermediate of in the synthesis of noradrenaline. And it took many years. And Honickiewicz actually wanted to go to catecholamine meetings, and he was they didn't let him in. They didn't let him talk about the dopa effect on the dopamine distribution in the brain. There was a meeting in Switzerland where they said, no, unfortunately, we don't have room for you to talk here. And the same happened to Carlson at a meeting where, at the end, one who summarized all the talk said, well, thanks God, nobody ventured on this idea that catecholamines had a role in motor function in the brain, although Carlson had talked about this at this meeting. So this was, and it takes many years, and these very short, I mean, I think also it's astonishing that you have two papers who are half a page in Nature and Science, and then another publication, and well, these three earned the Nobel Prize, actually. So yeah, this is, and nobody, at the beginning, nobody believed it. So I think it probably happens again with new findings. Probably was also the same with the deep brain stimulation at the beginning, that people were very skeptical.
Maybe, yes, maybe one word about that. I think what is very exciting is that Birkmeier had the possibility to give this therapy, because today he would not do it, because you will not get the substance and you will never inject the substance.
You will never get the right from the ethics committee.
There was no ethics committee.
Never, yes. Never.
Yes.
And if, and historical reminder, actually, after Birkmeier had done this, the first treatments, Gerstenbrand became interested in the clinic to do the same thing. And they also gave L-DOPA to a few patients with Parkinson's disease and saw positive effects. But then actually the head of the clinic, Hans Hof, prohibited to go on this line because it was initiated by Birkmeier. That Birkmeier had influenced Gerstenbrand, and Hof didn't like Birkmeier at all because he had been in the NSDAP and Hof had been an immigrant in America. So he prohibited any research on dopotherapy in Parkinson's disease. So that you have to think about this.
Yeah, a lot of personal things were going on at that time.
But one thing that we have really to address is you're too humble to say that, but your father was the mastermind behind this, because he had the age to mediate this, even if he did not do the job. So typically,
now in this context, I have to say it was Honickiewicz's idea, and my father saw the importance of this. But the idea actually was Honickiewicz's idea, and Honickiewicz had worked with dopamine already. So,
but you need a supporter. You need a senior personality to support this, especially if it is against the mainstream. And this was totally against the mainstream.
I'm sure that he supported Honickiewicz, but he was cautious at the beginning that Honickiewicz wanted to publish this already in 59. So, and I could understand Honickiewicz that he was very much afraid that the other groups would go ahead, because he thought that in Göteborg they must have done the same thing, but astonishingly they didn't look at Parkinson's disease, which was quite strange. And it really was a pity that Honickiewicz and Birkmeier and Carlsen didn't get the Nobel Prize together.
One thing that I would like to hear from you or from Dieter, this is, how was the world without dopamine? I know it, but maybe you can tell our attendants here.
Before, how would...
Keyword, awakenings.
That's... The awakenings is, of course, also interesting, because in this film, they actually only mention Kotzias, who as the inventor of the dopotherapy. And in fact, what's his name? The man who mistook his wife for a hat.
I lose the names already as well.
Oliver Sacks.
He was a pupil of Kotzias, and he had worked with Kotzias in New York. So he was also a proponent to distribute the story of L-Dopa.
This was going on 67. The publication 67. In Vienna was 61.
Of course. But still, a lot of things.
And as you mentioned, Thomas, you mentioned it. The big thing was levodopa therapy, no doubt. But the big thing was to combine it with benzerazine.
Yeah.
And this is still the gold standard of therapy 60 years later. And this was...
That's never mentioned, actually, this paper.
And this is Birkmeier and Mentasti. So two people from a peripheral hospital, a retirement home, actually, who had the idea and did it and published it. Many people have ideas but do not publish them. And published it and set really the path to a very great solution for many people on this planet. And I wanted to mention one thing, because people are always asking, after 20 years, 30 years, 25 years, 15 years, whatever, DOPA is losing his ability to work. This is definitely not true. What changes is the brain of the Parkinsonian patients, and the brains cannot store the dopamine. Yeah. And this is the cause why problems come around. Not the loss of the possibility to work.
But another word to the combination therapy. This is also a commercial thing. When Hoffmann LaRoche wanted to patent the combination of benzericide and L-DOPA and send it to the FDA for approval. The FDA didn't approve the combination of DOPA and benzericide, but they gave the word to other people working on this. So they quickly invented the combination of DOPA and
carbidopa.
Carbidopa, which was then used in CINEMED, and that was marketed in the United States and not Madopar. Mm-hmm. And that was a big commercial interest. And again, the power of the United States to suppress things which they don't want. Well, I don't want to allude to that too much, but
it's true. we know how it is. It's true. Okay.
Yes.
Let's come to an end. Yeah.
So, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Thomas. This was a great afternoon. Thank you very much. We had a new idea. François Alesch had a new idea. We always like when patients are involved in our talks, in our studies, in our discussions. So we are planning one of the next neurocasts together with the idea of patient-based research, so that we ask patients to fill out requests to do something. And I think many things are coming up at the moment. I'm going to post one in the chat, and you can easily take part on the www.parkinsonumfrage.at. You can read it in a minute, what it is going on there. And we will have, in not too long a time, 2, 3, 4, 5 such things we will report about and ask you about your ideas to do that, to take part. It is always necessary to have the input from the patient side. All of our attendants and listeners and watchers know that we want to have you as a patient and also the caregivers as co-therapeutes. We do not want to say from above what you have to do. We want to cooperate with you, so we need your input as well. So I'm finished for today. Pass over to François Alesch.
Yeah, okay, you will read that soon. We will post it. This will not be under Synapse Vienna. This will be for GTMed again, the Neurocast, specifically made for patients in German. And it will be, you can already note the date, it will be the 1st June. It will be probably the last one before summer, because today already, I do not understand why you are sitting here, because the weather is so fantastic. It's so fantastic outside. Yeah, it was hard for me to come in. I do not know. Dieter, he is in Ireland. He has only 14 degrees Celsius.
But nice weather, as you can see.
Thomas Brücke is in Vienna and is more or less the same than for me. I'm in Luxembourg. It's 25 degrees outside. So I think this is not the moment where you want to spend time in front of the of your screen. So maybe we will be more calm during the summer months, but in fall we will resume all these activities. We have a very fascinating program already in the pipeline. And for those who have not been able to see this, I think there are many, because of this climatic reason, this will stay here endlessly. So 10 minutes after finishing here, this will be available on the same place. Offline, of course, but you can see it, and you can see it later also in the library of the Gesellschaft der Ärzte, so the Physician Society in Vienna. So, okay, that's it. Thank you very much for staying with us, and see you soon again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.